Hello, my name is Philip Jarvis. At the moment I live in King Street in Maldon. Was born in Maldon and lived in Heybridge all my young years.
So, Philip, when did you leave school?
Very good question. 1964.
And you were how old?
15.
Okay, and did you get a job straight away?
I did, yeah. I worked for Capon for a little while. FGA Capon in Maldon. I didn't get on very well there at all. I was there for 9 months probably.
And what sort of work was that?
Joinery.
Joinery, okay.
And then I went straight to the Mayor Butcher in Heybridge Basin following that.
And which spent company? The rest of my said again? Which company in Heybridge Basin?
May and Butcher.
Right.
Which were, at that time, were quite big employers down in the basin. Along with Blackwater Timbers, of course. Mm. They were going flat out then, cutting the trees and preparing the timber and whatever. From I know in this area generally Blackwater Timbers cut a hell of a lot of timber at that time.
And how long were you an apprentice?
5 years, best part. 5 year apprenticeship then.
That sounds a long time to learn the work.
Certainly was. It was, but I mean now I think it's 2 years, but what do you learn in 2 years? And you don't learn it on site anymore, it's not hands on. Most of it is done in a college classroom and, you know, if you're very lucky, you might get out for a day or two, do the real thing, but that was all hands-on with us. Mm.
And was it a good time at Heybridge Basin when you were working there?
It was an excellent time, I thought. I thought it was an excellent time. Hard days compared to what they are now, probably. But, yes, they were excellent days. I enjoyed those days anyway.
And when you think back to Heybridge Basin, what do you think about?
God, where would I start with that one? The eel barges must be a big thing to start with, really, because I was, like I say, I was probably 14 when I started working there with Tom Polden, Molly's brother,
yep.
Cecil Stebbins, Darby Stebbins, George Clark, Dilbury Clark, Frank Clark, yeah. Well, like, all those basin guys around the same, they were older than me. Next generation to older, but they were all, you know, they were local guys, and that was all work to them. I mean, every pound was they needed desperately.
Tell me about the eel barges.
The eel barges were laid in a canal inside the lock. There were three, if I remember rightly, and they were like just like a big tank, a big holding tank. The eels came from Ireland, a big majority of them, as far as I can tell you. Were put in a tank and then taken out on a Saturday or whatever it was we done, Saturday morning, I think, and went all over the place, all live. Mm. They were all live eels.
Mm. And did they go up the canal?
No, they didn't. They were permanently moored in just inside the lock, right opposite where Cecil Stebbins lived at that time, just inside the gates.
So what were the eels? I mean, I suppose it was eel pie and
I suppose
cooking.
So they went to London, a huge amount went up to London, eels and mash or eels and liquor, did they call it, and what the Londoners used to have, I don't know. It was second nature to us because if we caught our own when we wanted them, then we'd do in a frying pan, and I never got involved in this jelly eel business. I couldn't face that.
And did you ever work on the eel barges? Did you have time to work on the eel barges?
Yeah, I used to do a Saturday morning on the eel barges with Tom and several of them.
Saturday morning, yeah.
Saturday morning, yeah, we used to get 10 bob. I remember getting 10 shillings, which is a lot of money then.
And what did you have to do for that 10 shillings?
Just put a damn great net on a long handle, down in the tank, lift out as many as you could get out, transfer them into a big bin, and then they went to...
Right.
In boxes or whatever, wherever they put them, we didn't get involved in that side of it. We just got them out, put them in the bins, and then they
disappeared.
Took them to wherever they took them and boxed them up, I imagine, or to somehow kept them alive to get up to London or wherever they went. But that was a big business in the basin at that time. Mm. That employed several people there down there. I mean, there were six and seven of us worked. Bernie Wisby was another one. From Maldon, Bernie and Joe, they worked there, so there would have been eight probably, if not more, working there on a Saturday.
And do you know how long the eel business carried on?
I can visualise it being there for certainly 2 or 3 years. Maybe 4 years, maybe even. It's a job to know. Once you started my apprenticeship, of course, I didn't get anywhere near as involved in it because I was working full-time 5 days a week down there, and I didn't really need... Then I started wildfowl shooting myself, and that time was important to me, so I didn't really get... The eel barge just sort of died a little bit of a... But in the very early days, I was only a young kid then.
Tell me about the wildfowl shooting.
Wildfowl shooting was going on in the basin by several people at that time. They always used punt guns, big punt guns that laid on the front of your punt. And there were probably four or five different people down there. One was a guy by the name of Squadron Leader Townsend, who lived at the bottom of North Street. He'd done a lot. Jamie Robinson, of course, the Stebbins boys. Tom Polden was involved in it. Frankie Clark was involved in it. I was involved in it. There was loads of people doing it. Because we were lucky enough just to be... just about come in when there was still birds to shoot at then. Mm. We were the last generation, really, that was made it, to make it viable.
And they were shot for food?
Yep.
To eat?
They were.
Did you sell them?
Yes, yeah, I did. Yeah,
sold quite... good market for
there was them. Always a market in those days. It wouldn't be now because people wouldn't know what to do with them now, but there was in those days. Yes, all the local people were eating that sort of stuff. That's how they survived.
Yeah,
basically. Then, you know, we're going back a long while now, aren't we? So 60 years moves on nearly.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's a hell of a long while.
So when you finished your apprenticeship after all those years, what did you do then?
I went straight out on my own.
Did you?
On site work, yeah. Straight away. As soon as I finished my apprenticeship, I went out on my own. And I stayed on my own all my life.
And you got lots of work?
Well, no, it wasn't very rarely ever out. The only time I ever was short of work was when we were waiting from one contract to finish for the next one to start. Mm. You might have had between phase one and phase two, you might have had a week, 10 days... Whatever, never was never out of work, ever.
And this was all within the Malden and Heybridge area?
No, Chelmsford and, you know, it Colchester. Sometimes I've done private stuff as far as Clacton and that sort of thing, but if it was site work, most of it was Malden, Chelmsford sort of area. Witham, I've done a lot of work in Witham in the early days. In actual fact, I think probably Witham would have been... the first big site contract I'd done on my own. For Cowards of Chelmsford, that was.
You say on your own. Were you literally on your own, or did you have any any staff or any employees?
No, not at that time. I was on my own for several years. Then I'd partnered up with somebody, and we worked together for quite a number of years, and we had one or two guys work for us on and off, but not permanently employed. You know.
So when that finally finished and you retired from carpentry, I believe you went into working on with local farmers and on the land.
I've worked with grandfather. Bear in mind, was a gamekeeper all his life locally up at Great Tottenham. He worked for the de Crepney family for 64 years. He was on the same estate, I think.
Can you say that name again?
De Crepney, Sir Claude de Crepney.
And the name of the gamekeeper was?
George Harding.
George Harding, okay.
And he was on that estate for 64 years and all, as a gamekeeper. Well, because of that, I got involved with the local farmers and the way it went from there, really. Mm. Vermin control and...
So what sort of thing did you do?
Rabbits, pigeons, moles, all sorts, whatever. Whatever was a problem at the time. Rabbits were a big thing in those days. Not so much now, of course, but in those days, rabbits were a real pain.
So the farmers would call you in?
Mm.
And how did you deal with the rabbits?
Traps and snares and ferrets and all the general things that went with catching rabbits. However and that, whichever. You know, whatever was the most successful. For me, at the end, towards the last, certainly the last 2 years I was doing it, traps were the way to go, live traps. You fed the traps, obviously, and in they went, and you dealt with them that way. Cause, simply because you could catch numbers of them that way. If you've got 60, 70 traps running, when there was a lot of rabbits, you could do really well. Snaring was another way, but the problem with snaring, of course, was excellent way of catching rabbits, but once a fox found them, you had constant problems.
Right.
You'd spend all day setting wires, and then fox would come along and clear you out overnight, decimate what you've got. He wouldn't kill just one, take one away, and, you know, he'd kill any amount, pull your snares all over the place, and it wasn't practical in the end.
Mm.
So we had to deal with him before we started all over again.
Right.
So, oh dear.
Tell me how you dealt with the foxes.
With a rifle, mate, basically, mainly. If we had real problems with them, we still do it now, to this day, if we have problems with foxes. See, nowadays, you're more... Commercial shoots are much more. They weren't commercial shoots when I was a youngster. They were all guests of the gentleman farmers, and, you know, the gentleman farmers had their own shoot and invited their friends, and so it went on. But nowadays, it's all commercial. Well, of course, that costs the farmers a lot of money now to buy these poults in every year for shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Once they get a fox in there.
Yeah.
So what we do, we have a bait point where we put a bait down, which would be a pigeon or rabbit or anything really edible for them, because they're scavengers. Once that bait starts to go on a regular basis, we just set up camp and shoot them with a rifle when they arrive.
I presume you have a special license. Do you need a special license?
You do for your firearms, of course, but you don't for shooting vermin, no. No, but I mean, again, that's all changed now to what it was. You have to be careful what you class as vermin now. For jays and magpies, that sort of thing, for example's sake, you can only kill legally if they're proven to be doing damage. Well, it's obvious that they are doing damage with young songbirds and nests and eggs, but you've got to prove that, which makes it that much more difficult. But, you know, we get over it one way or another.
So how long have
you been... I won't elaborate on that one too much, but...
How long have you been doing this, Phil?
How long have I been doing it? Since I was about 9. Well, with my grandfather, of course.
Oh.
He taught me how to set me snares and catch me rabbits with nets and various things, and so all my life, really, basically.
Mm.
So, well, if I was 10, let's say I was 10, that makes it 62 years. So a little while.
A little while. Yeah. And are you still in great demand for your services?
Not now, no.
No?
With the foxes, we still do quite a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But rabbits, of course, are gone now. There's no rabbits to what they were.
Mm-hmm.
It's little pockets of problems. With squirrels and various things, sometimes there'll be an area. Rabbits in particular, you'll find that one farmer will have serious problems with them. Next door, I've got none. Yet all of a sudden, the one that's got the problem, there'll be none there, and they'll move to the next farm and the next farm. And the reason for that, if they contact myxomatosis, which they still do to this day, if they contact that and it spreads amongst them, they run away from it. But they're not doing themselves any favours. Mm. They take it with them, but they go on to the next farm and the next farm, which is how it spreads the way it does. So, but I've still got all my kit, but very rarely do I set traps now. I can't with my back the way it is now, unfortunately. You've got to be bending down all day.
Sure.
You know.
Did you ever come across people who objected to what you were doing?
Yes, very often.
Really?
Very often. And there was a lady that lived 3 doors up here many years ago, Mrs. King. You remember Mrs. King?
I know of her, yes.
Her and I can't remember what the old man's name was now. No. Bob.
Bob King.
Bob and...
Evie.
Well, Evie, that's her name.
Mm.
She had absolutely... I don't know quite what happened, but we got into conversation over the foxes, generally speaking, over the foxes. For some reason, they were all over the place. When there was allotments down the back here, they were everywhere.
Mm.
And she said, oh, no, you can't, you dare, you mustn't kill them. They're lovely, are they? All right, okay. She said, they don't do any harm. Oh, really? No? They don't spread diseases? No, no, well, I do, I'm sorry, but they do. I'll try and help you understand it. And we went into all the logistics of it all and various things. In the end, she changed. She was completely opposite to what she was an hour previously.
Really?
Yep. She took it all on board.
Really?
And she was all right with it. Very good with it after that.
Yeah.
You know, mange is the big thing with foxes in the environment like we've got here. Now, for example, mange is a big thing. When you say fox mange, it's known as fox mange. But that not only does it stay with foxes, but it spreads among your cats, so it'll get in your dogs, and that's horrendous once you get it.
Mm.
If you speak to anybody who's supposedly in the know, like we get flyers come through the door, or we were at one time, saying, or we understand, or we are aware of the fact that there is a mange problem within the fox population, and that is possible it spreads, but you can get it treated by going to the vet, buying whatever medication you need, excuse me, at your expense.
Yeah.
Well, it's a hell of a lot cheaper to use a rifle bullet, basically, yeah. and the job's done, you know. But are still ongoing, and mange has become more and more of a problem now, because they're getting almost domesticated now, the foxes.
Mm. Does it worry you that we've got so many domesticated foxes?
Yes, it does. It's a worry, and it always will be a worry. I mean, and it will only get worse.
Mm.
Every house that's built will encourage another fox. So if you've got 4,000 more houses going in Malden at the moment, with a dustbin, each one of those houses has got a dustbin, and a food bin, separate food bin, that you're supposed to get. But how many people will adhere to that? A lot will, but a hell of a lot won't.
Mm.
So they'll capitalise on that, make no mistake.
Mm.
And they'll live under people's sheds, which they are now, in the garden. Any little bit of quiet ground, little bit of somebody's orchard in the back of
the allotments,
anywhere. That, if they can find a little haven, they will find it and capitalise on it.
And the worry is, as you've just said, they're spreading disease, mange.
They are.
To dogs and other pets.
Yep, I'm afraid they are. Well, there is no doubt that they are, in my mind. We've been very lucky. We haven't had them amongst our dogs. And I don't know anybody up this road that has either. I've never had the word mange ever mentioned to me. But it is rife. Because there is one at this moment in time, this very moment in time, that's living next to the school, just here.
Oh.
That's got horrendous mange.
Really?
I see it on a regular basis.
Yeah.
It's got a tail like a rat tail file with no hair on it at all. It's got half the hair on its body, and it looks horrendous. And that's got serious mange problems.
So you.
And that will spread to another one.
Yeah.
And then the cubs will get, if it has a litter of cubs, for example's sake. The cubs will contact that straight away.
Mm.
So, away you go.
So, if you were allowed to, would you want to shoot it?
Yes, definitely.
Mm.
Yeah, which I do quite often. I'm very careful. I've got to be very careful. What I say, it's not illegal. It's perfectly legal to do it. But where I'm doing it, in particular, here, is difficult.
Sensitive,
you understand what I mean? So, you go, I can't do it with a rifle, and so it's not practical. So we have to deal with them.
You tried trapping, didn't you?
Legally, that's right. It's the only way I can do it is to trap them. And then I'll kill them humanely in a trap.
Mm.
But, you know, we're not, right here at this moment, we're not unduly worried with them. But last year, I think, just at the back of my garden here, I killed 5 in 2 or 3 weeks.
Really?
Yeah, so but that problem was a problem at that time when the cubs come along, which the cubs will be now, any time now.
Mm.
that will start all over again. So so it rolls, you know.
Phil, you mentioned your dogs. How many dogs have you got?
Three now, at the moment. I've just lost the old one. She was 14, nearly.
Oh, over 14.
Over 14.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
So at the moment, I'm working three.
Yeah. And do you take them out with you?
I take them out all the time. I'm working them on the shoots 3 days a week.
Oh, are you?
Yeah,
oh.
Locally. And well, I'm doing Essex, Suffolk. Mainly Essex and Suffolk anyway. But I've got opportunities to go wherever, but I'm not capable of doing it anymore, to be honest.
So these are working dogs?
3 days, these are working dogs.
And what do you do on the shoots? What do you
pick
do
up
yourself?
The game after it's shot, basically.
Okay.
Stand behind the guns and pick up whatever.
Mm. So you send the dogs out all the time. Yeah. I presume they know what to do anyway.
Yeah. Well, I trained. They're not... Yeah, if the dogs are of working stock anyway, from working stock, then it's naturally built in, inbred, to a point. But it's up to you then. Mm. You have to make the best of, you know, what you've got. It's a lot of hard work, I can assure you of that.
So you go to the shoots on a regular basis?
3 days a week.
3 days, right. Right.
Yeah.
Is there a day off today?
My day off today, I'm out. No, not tomorrow, I'm out Friday.
Saturday.
Monday and Friday. And then finish for the season. Mm. Yeah, only we get an invite. We get invited at the end of the season to two or three different places, and then it's all over.
So there are plenty of shoots going on.
There's still a lot of shooting going on. But what the shoots are tending to do now, some of them anyway, is cut down on the numbers that they shoot. Because there's a hell of a lot of anti now. Yeah. Anti this, anti that, anti for whatever the reason. Everything's changing in the world of ammunition. It's all got to be non-toxic. Well, it hasn't legally at the moment. They reckon that in the next 5 years, they will have switched over from lead...
Right.
To non-toxic.
Right.
Whichever. Could be bismuth, tungsten, steel, whatever is non-toxic.
Mm. Mm.
Europe have been doing it. Denmark, for example, they've been doing it for 20 years. No lead in Denmark. Right. Same with rifle bullets, but how we're going to get over that, I don't know. I won't need to be worrying about it too much by that time. I wouldn't have thought. But there you go.
Yeah.
But it is a changed world now, definitely.
Phil, can we go back to your childhood, basically? You were taught by your grandfather, you said.
Absolutely.
Country ways. Yep. Would you like to just say a bit about him?
Country ways were totally different way of life to what they are now. I mean, legally you could do things in that era that you can't do anymore. And I agree with it, mainly, really, the change, I have to say. I mean, trapping, for example, is much more humane now. If you're going to trap an animal now in a spring trap, it's much more humane than it used to be years ago, because they used to use gin traps. Gin traps were not very nice at all. I mean, they were very effective, but they were not really humane. They were very cruel things, I think. But we've moved on from that now. If you're going to still use a spring trap, they are much more humane than they ever used to be. Because they had to be, legally. They've changed all these things all over Europe. And we're coming at the end of that, really. I mean, like I said about Denmark, they've been doing much more humane things with traps and different ammunition for 20 years or more.
So who did your grandfather work for?
He worked for, in the early days, he worked for Sir Claude de Crepney. He ran away from home when he was about 12, 13. Left home because his father was... Anyway, we won't. No need to worry about that so much. But he ran away. He was from Shropshire originally.
Oh.
And he ran into the next county of Staffordshire. And he knocked on the door of a farm and asked for work, and he got it straight away. When he was 14... He was working a pair of horses with a plough at 14 years old. Then when the war started, he came off the farm and he worked on the railways in London. London Railways that were bombed all over the place and everything else. But whilst he was there, of course, he met grandmother. She was a Londoner. The rest is history, really. And then he moved down here to and got the job as a gamekeeper on the estate at Great Tottenham here. And he was there for 64 years.
Was he?
Mm-hmm. And of course I learnt all that aspect of life, if you like, from him, basically.
Mm. So as a gamekeeper, what did that involve?
Gamekeeping basically involved looking after not only a game, dealing with the vermin. It was a custodian of the estate, really. I mean, fauna and flora, everything that went with it was a gamekeeper's job to look after. If they had a problem with anything, vermin wise, or he was straight away called on. The gamekeeper got the job of sorting it out one way or the other. In actual fact, they were very well thought of in the early days, the gamekeepers, very well thought of, because they were given a free hand, really, to run that chute. If they were running a chute, for example, like Sir Claude de Crepney was very, very influential man all over, everywhere else. Quite what he'd done, he was from French descent, but quite what his business was, I don't know that. But he was very influential because they had some people down from London. Alec Douglas Hume used to come down and shoot down here. A lot of names that were well up in politics and all sorts of things.
So there were a lot of shoots on that estate on a regular basis.
They used to shoot that fortnightly, every fortnight. But they were all invited by, not Sir Claude de Crepney, when I remember it, because he was gone. I've still got photographs upstairs of my mother on the lawn of the big house with Sir Claude de Crepney when she was about 9 or 10.
Gosh, yeah.
I've still got that. But he'd gone by the time I was that sort of age.
Mm.
But his descendant was a guy by the name of Colonel Lancaster. And he was, I don't know what he was into, stocks and shares or quite what he was, but he had a flat on the Embankment in London. So he spent most of his time in London, but then when his shoot days came up, he was down here, stayed on the estate at Great Tottenham there in the big house.
Did you want to follow in your grandfather's footsteps?
Yeah, I did, which is why he said to me, if you're intended to be a gamekeeper, you've got to go away to learn it, away from this area, because there's no future here. And he was absolutely right, proved to be. The estate is now sold off into bits and we'll never be again.
And building on half of it.
Well, it will be. Most of it will be built on eventually.
Yeah.
You know, but...
So there are still...
Heybridge Wood and...
Heybridge Wood is still there because they've not been able to get permission to knock it down. They tried very hard. Going back probably 40 years, there was a firm by the name of Beezer Homes, I believe they've called. I'm sure it was Beezer Homes. They bought the land. They bought the wood and part of the land adjacent to it with a view of building houses. But they wouldn't let them knock any of the wood down. And they went years and years and years they tried to get that. But it's still there. So they were never... They had to... this the order thing on it. That
so your grandfather dissuaded you?
He did, in as much as he told me that if I wanted to do it, I've got to go away and learn it.
Yeah,
that was the dissuasion in itself, really. I mean, 15, did I really want to leave home? Not really, because I didn't know anything at all then.
So you know, come back to it as a sort of a retirement.
It's a sideline. I've done it all my life, basically. It's a sideline, you know, in spare time and nights and, God, I've been on... Thousands of hours I've been doing it. Thousands of hours over the years. But well, yeah, sometimes you got paid a little bit by the farmers.
Mm.
Or if you didn't get pound notes, you got paid in other ways. You know, there was always a... Because in the early days, when I was first doing it, really, you'd done each other a favour. Somebody would give you a bag of potatoes, and you'd give somebody a pheasant in return, or whatever it was. It was a totally different world to what it is now. Totally different world.
Philip, can we go back again?
The landlord of the ship at Hayby's Basin was a guy by the name of Mick Green. I'm sure he was Mick. I'm sure we called him Mick. But him and Dobbsy run the ship at the Basin for several years, two or three years, I can remember anyway. And he was one of the main customers for wildfowl and hares and rabbits and whatever. He bought a lot off of us. Pheasants that we used to get out of somebody's tree, if we were lucky at those days.
And how often did you go out shooting?
As often as I could. We were down every single weekend. Sometimes after work, we'd be down a river if the tides were right. A lot, an awful lot. Hell of a lot.
And you had a punt gun?
Yep. Which was a muzzle-loading gun. A big, heavy muzzle-loading gun that laid on the front of the punt.
Right.
That would... the object of it was to kill as many as you could in the early days, but we didn't need to do that quite as much. But that was the sport of it.
And did you use dogs to go and retrieve?
No, because you was in your punt. You could pick all your birds up that you'd shot on the water with your punt gun.
Okay.
Pick them up yourself. You didn't.
So you
went
on the marshes. You were just in the water.
You were afloat here when you were punt gunning. You were alongside the Sultans most of the time. Sometimes you'd go across a bit of open water, but you wouldn't be shooting much here on open water.
Mm.
Usually under the count of the Sultans, or depends what you were shooting, really. You could shoot mallard out in the middle. They'd tolerate a little punt more than a lot of the other ducks would. So, yeah.
So that was a useful bit of pocket money.
We done it. We done quite nicely out of it, really.
Mm.
I remember when we were apprentices, we had a friend and I. We had a price board on a wall in the workshop. With how much was a brace of pheasants, and how much were widgeon, and how much were teal, and how much was a rabbit, and how much whatever. Yeah.
And there was a good market for them all.
A good market. We never got lumbered with anything.
Well, that's good. Thanks, Phil.